Doesn't that computer know who you
are? Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is me.
A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same
I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
Onto a Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah,
blah, blah, blah, blah, blah, blah, blah.
This is Tech Talk.
Good morning. Yeah, that'll get you woken up a little bit. It is Saturday, June 25th, 2016, and you are listening to Tech Talk on WRLR 90.3 LPFM in around Lake Heights, Illinois. And I think we've got our good friend Dave, Mr. Dave Sparky Saganaki. No, maybe not. I don't know. Let's see if we can figure this out here again. Hey, Dave, we got you there.
Test.
I think we got him. Can you hear us?
Michael!
Oh, there he is. I knew it. I'm so good at pushing buttons. I think I'd be better at this at some point.
Well, good morning. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. It's Tech Talk.
Yeah, and a lovely Saturday it is too. Throughout the listening area, wherever you may be, so long as that is not England, I think you're probably waking up pretty happy today. So. Hopefully. Of course, I'm talking about the Brexit. That'll be, I'm sure, a topic of discussion around, but I was going to discuss some things to do with that as well. And
I'd love to hear it. What do you got?
Well, you know, and I think we'll bring Jay on, our good friend Jay, as well. He always has a great insight into some of this stuff. There's a few other things going on in the world, and I do have a very good, cool site of the week this week, too.
Can't wait to hear about it.
You know, maybe we should flip things today. Maybe I'll start with that, and then that way I won't be in a big rush at the end of the show.
Yes, often it gets cool sites of the week. Oftentimes, just doesn't get done because of time constraints at the end of the show. I think it's a great way to start.
Well, let's do it then. Let's do it. I'm going to start with mine. I don't know if you have one queued up for the day, but if you do, we'll follow with that. So mine, though, I'm excited about this. I was so excited. In fact, my wife was out of town, and I sent her a Facebook message. I was like, wait till you get home. You're going to love this. This is the best thing ever. I feel like I've been looking for this, and she, of course, could care less, but... But I feel like I've been looking for this forever. People that listen to the show regularly know, of course, we do a lot of conversation, a lot of discussion surrounding security, surrounding passwords and all this. And anybody out there using computers knows you've probably got like 10,001 passwords or websites that you need a password for. And you fall into kind of one of three groups. You're either just use the same password for everything. Or if you do, create new and different passwords, you just forget them all and have to reset them all the time. Or if you're fortunate, if you're kind of connected to stuff, maybe you do have a way of storing those. And I've been a big fan of KeePass for a long, long time. KeePass
really? For a very long time, you've advocated that.
Yes,
program.
Yes. There's things that I love about it in that it's a KeePass management system. It doesn't have. You can add on like a lot of bells and whistles if you want to, but the bottom of it is, the base of it is very clean and simple. It's an encrypted data storage. It has one master password for the database, and then you get in and you look at it. And it's like Craigslist too. It's like, you know, the interface doesn't look like anything neat. There's nothing interesting about it, but it's very secure. It's completely owned by you, and it's open source. So as opposed to some of the very, very good alternatives out there, LastPass and 1Pass and RoboKey and things like this, all of those are great too, but there your data lives in the cloud, and you're typically paying a monthly or yearly fee for the access. The big hindrance, though, and the big problem to adopting KeePass, and this has been a frustration for my wife. This is why I thought, oh, she's going to be as excited as I am, but no. But the big hindrance is because it is this database table, it is a database file that has to sit somewhere. You're not in the cloud. There's not a lot of resources for accessing it either. There's not like a really fancy bells and whistles sort of iPad, iPod, Android phone sort of app. You know, if you're on your Chromebook in particular, it can be really painful because your Chromebook isn't designed even to have local apps installed so much. And then this last week, I ran across something called KeyWeb, and that's spelled K-E-E Web. KeyWeb.info is the website, and this, it's the coolest thing ever. I'm so excited about it. I'm using it. I've got it up right now, as a matter of fact. The neat thing with KeyWeb is it's very, very similar. If you're used to KeyPass, you actually use your KeyPass database within it, but it gives you a web-based as well as a desktop-based interface to access your KeyPass password files. And so it'll work on any device, anywhere, and connects. I have my KeyPass database file in my Dropbox account, but you can put it in Google Drive or your OneDrive or WebDAV or whatever it is that you want, wherever you want to store it, you can store it on the web yourself. So it's not open to hackers, and access it that way. And it's beautiful. It's a wonderful thing. And the interface is very nice. It's sleek. It takes a little bit of finagling to make things work and connect with your database just how you want it. But once it's done, it's updating everywhere when you make a change, and it's accessible everywhere when you want to get it. So I'm very pleased. I haven't been this excited about a cool site of the week for I don't know how long. which says something about me, I know, but that's okay.
Does,
I'm okay with that.
Would you recommend this for folks that are digitally challenged or not quite computer literate?
You know, it would be tough. I think it would depend on the level of illiteracy, I guess, or if they had a helping hand. Once it's set up, it's very easy. There's literally like a one-step, two-step process. And in fact, once it's configured and set up, you double click on it or you go to the KeyPass Info website and there's just, it's all set for you. It maintains what's configured already, and you just have to put in your KeyPass password and away you go. So to that extent, I would say yes, I would absolutely support it for people that are somewhat challenged. It's just, I do understand that some of the setup is going to be a little confounding to people. And that's where those password storage and retrieval sites like LastPass and 1Pass are so good. I would also, though, highly recommend, you know, if you're using Google Chrome, Google Chrome has its own password saving feature. If everything you do is on the web, that may be enough for you these days. And as long as you're logged into Google Chrome with a Google account, it will save and store those passwords across all of your devices.
But if somebody has access to your computer, then they can get onto all of your sites as well.
Absolutely. And that is a downside. You know, which is why I would also recommend making sure you turn on two-factor authentication, which if somebody tries to log into your account from any machine that you haven't logged into before, it'll send you a text message with an account code to authorize that access. That at a bare minimum, that's what you need to do. If you're storing important information through the Google universe or the Google Chrome universe, you absolutely need to get out there and turn on two-factor authentication.
Wow. Well, and this leads us into something else. You brought up Chromebooks, something that you've spoken very highly of in the past, and you mentioned that they don't even like you to... The Chromebooks have not, up until this point, had the ability to have apps on the book itself, right?
That's right. I know where you're going with this. Absolutely.
Okay, well, why don't you take it? Simply put, they are rolling out books now, Chromebooks, that will, in fact, allow you to access to the Google Store and allow you to put apps on your phone. On your Chromebook.
That's right. Yeah, the same apps that you can put on your Android phone, they're going to begin, and it's already started. They've already rolled out some updates for existing users, and then some of the newer ones that are coming out are already ready for that. They will let you install some of the same apps that you can get on the Play Store. Now, from what I understand, they also, too, have some specific stores. Like, there's like a Samsung store for the Chromebooks and things like this. I'm not sure how this all mixes together yet. I haven't had a chance to play with one that allows you to install the Android apps on it yet.
Well, it's brand new. They made the announcement last month, I believe, and They have a developer access for developing apps for the Asus Chromebook Flip and the Acer Chromebook R11. So it's really in a nascent early stages trying to get going with this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. And you know, it's funny that I feel like they've finally sort of caught up a little bit, because as a PC user and even as a Mac user, we've had the ability to run a great number of Android apps from the Play Store on your PC through Chrome. Actually, if you have the Google Chrome browser, you can install, there's a thing called ARC, App Runtime for Chrome, that was released back September before last, I think it was, somewhere around there. And you install ARC, and then you can literally, you just load up your Android apps. And there you go. Yeah, thank you. And away you go. And I'm actually looking at a site right now. And of course they've got, you know, Candy Crush. They're showing people playing Candy Crush on there. But I had used it actually for a little while because the interface for Facebook Messenger I liked a lot better than the one that was that came with the Macintosh. So there are some neat things you can do with it. They've had that capability when it was a Mac. Now it's finally coming through to the Chromebooks.
Very cool.
Yeah. No, I thank you for bringing that up, because that's I think that's a very cool thing. That's a very cool thing.
Yeah, and knowing you, you'll probably get your hands on one pretty quickly and give us a review.
I'm hoping so. You know, it. I haven't sat down and played with the Chromebooks that we have in our house yet to see if you can actually do this already. But I think it'll work. And there's good information on Google. If you go to the Google Help, there's Chromebook Help site, support.google.com/Chromebook. You'll find a lot of information and things about that, about which apps you can use, which ones are ready to go, and how to get in there and access them. There's also good information. This is why I had looked into that area already. Of course, I have some apps out there for the Android store. You'll be able to run the WRLR app on your Chromebook now, so you can go in there and do it. Although there are some tips and hints for developers, they're suggesting, in fact, that you're going to want to port some features and functionality specifically to the way that they need to be supported to run well on Chromebooks. So I'm going to have to look into that and see if I need to put in some elbow grease on the programming to fix that.
And that's the coolest app of all, and the only one you really need is the WRLR app.
It's so easy to find. Just go to your favorite Play Store, whether it be Android, Apple, or Amazon, and then just type in WRLR, and bingo bango. You'll be listening to us 24/7. No problems.
Oh, and speaking of WRLR stuff, isn't this Round Lake Beach weekend? Aren't we appearing there?
This is it. This is the week. In fact, yeah, we've got me, and then I've got Rob Rigel, who is right after me, and that's it for in-house programming today. You're going to be listening to Beach Fest live. So it starts Friday, June 24th. That was yesterday, through Sunday of this week. thank you very much for the segue, Dave, by the way. Listen to this. This is awesome. The fest is including headliner band performances, cultural entertainment stage. There's a whole stage dedicated to that. Family-friendly activities, face painting. There's a carnival, food, and beverage tent, and even more. There's going to be a Battle of the Bands contest that's starting out tonight, Saturday, June 25th. Destination is 2007 Civic Center Way. It's right next to the Metro station. So if you're familiar with Round Lake Beach at all, it's right by the Metro station. We're going to be there. We're kicking off the summer at Beach Fest for the Village of Round Lake. The schedule today, Saturday, noon to 1, you're going to have Al Weissman with In a Nutshell. 1 to 2, Frank Tarchisky with Music Matters. 2 to 3, Mark Shanahan with Doo Wop. 3 to 4,
all right,
Adam Hoon with the Perpetual Playlist. And 4 to 5, Chris Zimmerman with something just a little bit different. So it's going to be a good day today. I think they're going to have a lot of fun.
That's exciting and very ambitious to have all those folks out there doing their shows live. And it's always so much fun. The Beach Fest is great. And the fact that WRLR can be a part of it is a fantastic thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that I'm seeing those names on the list for today means that they didn't lose anyone at the boat event last week. So that's cool.
Maybe they just haven't updated the list.
Could be. It's not waterlogged though either. So it's not water soaked. So I'm assuming the boat did not tip over. I just wasn't able to do that this year. I'm hoping maybe next year I'll get on the boat again. So we were talking about Chrome. I told Jay, of course, I was like, hey, I'm going to try and bring it early. I'm not doing it. Cause I have one last thing I want to close off with. Speaking of Chrome browsers and Chromebooks, only fair to talk about how they've just done a recent analysis of browsers and the impact the browser that you choose will have on your laptop battery life. And Microsoft Edge, they claim 53% longer battery life if you are using Microsoft Edge as your primary browser, as opposed to Google Chrome. I love Google Chrome. I'm very just linked into the Chrome verse, whatever you want to call it, and I
ecosystem or pond.
Yes, exactly. The whatever that is, I'm deeply entrenched into it. But it's kind of like the thing that you love to hate. I have issues all the time with computer slowdowns, with RAM usage going through the roof, with one thing after another, and almost always it's related to something stupid in Chrome. It does have a big memory leak issue. It doesn't.
But it's not related to the 27 windows you have open, right?
Well, that's what I was just going to say. It doesn't handle that well. Other browsers actually handle that much better. In fact, that's one of the bigger differentiators between Chrome and Microsoft Edge. Edge handles multiple windows open much more intelligently, and how it distributes the memory and how it preloads and all the other stuff. Chrome leans towards assuming that you just have a rocking huge amount of RAM and everything else, and that your main goal is you want, when you click on a web page tab, that it's open and ready to roll immediately. Microsoft Edge takes a little bit different tact on it and really tries to economize on the amount of RAM that's being used for you. Now, you spoke of tabs. I will throw in, here's my bonus cool site of the week. If you
ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, if you're using, I don't know if this works in Edge. In fact, I'm pretty sure it doesn't, but I use it. I use it a lot in Firefox and also in Chrome. It's wonderful. Speaking of all these tabs open and stuff. So bookmarking, of course, is one thing. You can bookmark stuff and make sure and read later or open up later, whatever you want to do. But there's a better solution even than that. That I've found. It's called One Tab, and it's a Chrome extension. Go search for it in the Chrome extension house, or there's also Firefox, the Firefox extension store there. One Tab, it's called. And the cool thing with it is it does kind of what you say. It creates one tab, and it has a symbol. It looks kind of like a funnel, and any pages and sites that you're on that you're like, well, I don't want to close this because I need this, but I don't need it open right now, and my machine's going super, super, super slow. You can click one button, or you can right-click and select which tabs you want to go into a special holding pen called One Tab. And then when you're ready to bring them up again, you just go over there and click on them, and they come out of there and onto your main browser window. And
that's available for Firefox and Chrome, and it's called again?
One tab. Yeah, the only thing I'll warn people about, don't presume that it's like bookmarks where it's going to be across all of your browsers everywhere like your Chrome bookmarks are. They aren't. It's machine specific, which also brings, of course, the danger that if for whatever reason your machine blows up or melts down or something, if you think you're storing those permanently, you're gonna lose them. It's kind of like flash drives. I've had this discussion with people before, is that your flash drive should be seen as a transportation medium, not as a storage medium. If you're putting something on flash, take it to the machine that you want it to be on, put it on there, and then don't worry about it. You don't put stuff on a flash drive and then label it and stick it in your closet or whatever, or carry your most valuable thesis document that you've got and put it on a flash drive and carry that around in your backpack and then be shocked and surprised that, oh no, the thing got melted, or broke.
Yeah, well, so you're saying it's not a good strategy for long-term storage.
That's right. But it is nice for getting, clearing out the browser windows, throwing them into one tab, boom, and your machine runs a lot faster instantly. So it's it's good for that. Good for that kind of stuff.
I haven't had good experiences with portable disk drives either, left for long periods of time and going back to them years later. I don't think they're really meant to sit that long, it seems.
No. Like. Yeah, they do have a shelf life, it seems. I would agree. I would agree with that. And I've run into that problem too. And even to a lesser degree, but definitely has happened to me with DVDs. Not so much with CDs, but with DVDs. I have had that problem where I go back, I try to pull up the information that's in there, and...
That's tragic. No, I'm guessing that ringing is for our good friend Jay Garman.
Yeah, we'll see if he stuck around.
Hello.
Oh, and there he is.
There he is.
I know. I told you. I said, hey, I'm going to get you on early today, Jay. And lo and behold, we're not. But I did kick out the cool sites of the week early, so we wouldn't feel so rushed at the end. But I had wanted to bring you on before we started talking about Brexit and all that fun stuff, because I just knew you'd have some good insight to that.
That's when you eat breakfast when you're running out the door, right?
Yeah, that's a Brexit. Exactly. That's. I wish that's what it was. So actually, in fact, in my Twitter feed someone posted and said Brexit should be a breakfast, a British breakfast made up of English muffins, crap, racism, and inequality. And that's...
Well, how do you really feel, Mike?
Yeah. you know what? It's making Britain great again. That's what it's all about. Oh, man. No, you know what was fun, though? So this is where I was going to lead off with, though. What was fun was, of course, a very good thing. So the British people did a really, really good thing. So one of the things that you can do, of course, when an election is coming, a huge important thing is happening, is you want to do your research. You want to find out what's going on. You want to know what the current situation is, what the results may be. And it turns out that Britain, in fact, it showed a huge, huge spike in Google requests and Google searches surrounding what is the EU, what is Plan 50, what is the benefit of leaving, all this. A huge spike in this, in these types of requests. So people were being informed about the vote. The unfortunate downside is, of course, they were making these requests and queries the day after the vote was taken. So how much good they did, I don't know. Which is why, you know what, I'm going to do my one soapbox thing I'm going to say today. We should do the same thing here in America. A vote's coming up in November, but please don't follow Britain's lead. Do your Google searches now. Type in, who is Donald Trump? Type in, tell me about Hillary Clinton's email. And even go so far as to look into Gary Johnson, the Libertarian Party. Some of the things that are happening. Don't wait until the day after to type in, what will the world look like with President Trump? Do that before. Do the due diligence before the vote this time around.
That would be good.
Yeah.
There's a step beyond that, though. So I totally get the point about the Google searches are valid. I think another point to take from this is that just like it was here, the polling in Britain was terribly inaccurate, mm-hmm. because they basically showed Remain with like a 3-point edge basically until halfway, three quarters through voting. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of like, wait, I went to bed and we were remaining and I got up and we left. how did that happen?
You went to bed too early, yeah.
Yeah, but basically, which is hilarious considering it's the younger vote that voted to remain and the older vote who voted to get out. So mm-hmm. you would have thought it would have gone the other way. But it's just sort of hilarious to me how bad polling models have gotten on both sides of the Anglophone world. And third, the point I want to sort of push out about, do your research. Britain may be the only non-dictatorial country on Earth that has a worse media landscape than the United States. I mean, they really perfected irresponsible tabloid journalism far more than even we have. I mean, sort of the partisan, you know, stay in your own bubble, believe the worst about your opponents model that we use here mm-hmm. was invented there and perfected there and sort of brought across the pond. So I'm sure a lot of folks thought they were informed about the vote mm-hmm. because they only went to their comfortable news sources and never went to anyone impartial or even opposition to figure out what they had to say. So it was, you know, they may have done research. It just wasn't valid research.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that was kind of the interesting thing too. And I do rely on getting news from the UK quite a bit, especially for world news. BBC, Sky News are two of my go-to resources. And, but you're right. The level of, I don't know what to put it, the partisan inanity is just as extreme, if not more extreme there, as it is here. It's their accents. I always think, you hear that accent, and you're like, oh, they must be so smart and put together. And then yeah. and then you look into their politics and realize it's not quite there. It is, the polling was interesting, I think, and people, of course, are making a lot of comparisons between the rise of Boris Johnson and with the Brexit and pushing Brexit and all this with Trump and the same sort of anger and feelings and the things that are allowing a man like Donald Trump to rise in the U.S. are the same things, I think, that pushed the Brexit polling over the limit. One question I have, my feeling on this, I know this is not a technical kind of thing, and I'll push it over into technology in a minute here, but you know, it just seems like this is a vote of such moment, just a huge, hugely momentous decision that had to be made. And I love the fact, on the one hand, that it's so democratically chosen and decided that it was literally like a 1.9% swing that made the difference in the decision. But part of me is also horrified by the fact that that slight of a margin could bring about such a dramatic, if not traumatic, change in the direction and fate of one of the world's leading countries. Shouldn't that have been like a, you know, 2/3 majority to do something like that? I don't know. Or am I just off base? Is this a really cool thing that they can do that?
Well, no, actually, it's my understanding there are actually petitions in the EU now to change the EU charter that you cannot resign from the EU without, if I remember the terms of the petition, you have to have at least 51% of the electorate turn out for the vote. So you have to have a majority of people voting, which I'm not sure how often that happens for anything anywhere, except in Australia where they fine you if you don't vote. And two, I think it has to be a 75% vote of that 51% to leave.
Wow.
So,
wow.
They're going to make it basically harder to do this because they legitimately are concerned with the notion of other countries wanting out.
Yeah. Well, now that being said, though, the numbers I heard was that something like 70 to 75% of registered voters did show up for this vote, which is nearly unheard of. So
that was not the issue in Britain. You are correct. The turnout was not the issue in Britain, but the EU wants to change the formula by which you would do that.
Yeah.
So you couldn't just have, you know, basically vote depression and get this vote if you want it. They want to make sure that this is actually the will of the majority, and then they want to make it harder to meet the leave threshold, which I think the second part of it, maybe, you know, basically making it impossible to leave. Although
yeah.
I don't know how you stop a country from leaving if they don't want to. Like we're just not going to be part of this anymore, and unless you invade us, I don't know how you stop us. That's sort of a whole separate conversation. And you know, we could debate that the technical, pros and cons of being in it. I think it's interesting to me, just reading the tea leaves, that the main reason, other than the sort of the rank sentimentality of we should be our own country and no one in Brussels should be able to tell us what to do, which, okay, that's a fine little knee-jerk reaction. It's not really a mature political opinion. What really sort of pushed it over the edge was the refugee crisis coming from Syria, which is clearly a temporary situation. I think the more legitimate concern, which was not brought up, is what the heck happened to Greece when basically the downside of being in the euro showed up, which is not what, you know, Britain isn't dealt with that because they haven't joined the euro. I would have thought that, you know, the more larger concern on the part of the EU would be not more people wanting to leave like Britain or even wanting to have a relationship that Britain just got rid of, which was we're in, but we don't want to be part of the euro because we really want to be able to depress our currency if things go wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, and that was interesting too, was the discussion surrounding how kind of misinformed a little bit and perhaps misguided some of the rhetoric was, you know, even ignoring the immigration issues and things like that, but also too about the, you know, take control of our country. The reality, of course, being that we all live in a global economy, and what the UK has voted to do in essence is to say we don't want to be part of the decision making anymore. You know, because the largest block of countries in the world that they're right next to, they now will not have a seat at the table for how that's done. They won't have to contribute directly to the success of that block. That's true. But they also, too, won't be able to direct how those decisions are made there internally. And then with the with how close they are, not just geographically, but also, too, with the intertwining of all of the different industries and so on. That seems like a really strange decision to make. And of course, bringing it back to tech now, that intertwining, that's where a lot of people are very, very concerned with how the tech industry is going to survive and thrive or not in Britain and in the EU in general. One of the bigger issues is, of course, that that human capital, you know, not talking about just immigration and that being an issue one way or the other, but the fact that up until now, or until this changes and this goes into effect, people and ideas and data have been able to flow across EU borders essentially unhindered, and to be able to share and work together. I was just reading recently something like 15% of the professors at the leading colleges and universities in Britain are from outside of the UK. They're not citizens. They're actually migrating in and out over those EU borders freely. And that's not going to be possible soon. They're really going to be shutting that access down for everybody.
Well, yeah. And actually, I thought one of the more telling signs was a lot of folks on this side of the pond aren't aware of this. But if you were born in Northern Ireland or you have an Irish parent or grandparent, as a citizen of the UK, you can easily and almost automatically apply for an Irish passport. And there has been an ungodly spike in applications for Irish passports and Irish dual citizenship because Ireland is staying in the EU, and everyone who possibly can wants to maintain that freedom of movement to and from the continent. It's extremely vital, especially for tech startups, which are multiply located, to be able to move back and forth easily without basically stopping at a customs checkpoint every time they get on a train or get on a ferry. It's a major inhibitor of transit of talent to and from Britain if they basically withdraw entirely from the EU and all of that free movement zone. I think I'm going to forget how to pronounce like the Schengen zone or something like that, where they basically, once you're in the EU, moving within EU states is as easy as moving between states in the United States, more or less.
Yep.
Other than the language barrier is a little bit different, although having traveled from Boston to Alabama, you know, there is still a language barrier between those two as well.
And Southern Kentucky, let us forget. You're way up on Northern Kentucky land there. It's not so different.
Yeah.
But
well, my family's from Southern Kentucky, so I speak the dialect. It's not that hard for me. But, you know, when you've adjusted to Boston, and then you're driving from Louisville to Florida, and you're stopping around Birmingham for lunch, it's like, oh right, yeah, that's you are technically speaking the same language I just got used to, but there's a bit of a filter adjustment for me here.
Yeah.
I can understand either one, Alabama or Boston, frankly. But what do you guys think of the effort to get a revote, the 500,000 signatures that have already been gathered to petition for a revote, and or London wants to be separate from the rest of England.
Well, you know, actually, that I think is a really, really fascinating point. And another parallel, in fact, this cycle between what's happening in American politics and what's happening in English or in the UK. One of the silver linings that I have commented on with friends frequently to the whole tumultuous, really no good choices sort of election that we've got coming up. And also, too, though, the tumultuous primaries and what was looking to be probably a really, really highly rancorous and intense election cycle is that a lot of the discussion is not so much anymore on who's best and my party is great and yours is terrible and you're all idiots and no, you guys are. A lot, although that's there. A lot of the discussion lately has been on, oh, my gosh, I had no idea how horribly broken our electoral system is. I had no concept how deeply, deeply injured our democracy was and how far away from, I think, the common perception of how we elect our officials and how our government works, how incredibly far away from the reality that is. I believe this is some of that same thing happening in England. We've been very content. We've been very fortunate. Although we've had swings of good and bad, we haven't had terrible, terrible leadership. We haven't been forced to really, you know, put our face in the muck as we have been this cycle. And the same thing's happened here now in England. And perhaps this will be a positive thing, is it will force them to reevaluate their democracy as well and fine tune it.
Actually, I would argue the flip side is they were the electorate of Britain, as in most, how shall we say, quote-unquote, mature democracies, is there's so much machinery between the will of the people and what government does that when you give them a direct choice referendum, they are entirely unprepared for the notion their vote has a consequence. Like, that's what really, I think, threw a lot of people, because you saw the interviews of, well, I voted to leave, but I didn't think it would actually happen. You know, I was just voting as a sort of a symbolic protest, or, you know, it was sort of this notion of the people in charge are going to do whatever they want to do, and I'm sort of voting to give them a sense of what I want, but it won't. They're still going to do what they want to do, and it's sort of like, this is just sort of my nudge in sort of a general direction. Is like, my vote doesn't really matter. And I think in the United States, it's sort of been this you know, on the Republican side, it's been they sort of got sort of a demagoguery in the will of the most vocal minority, the most well-organized minority, sort of organized in quotes, won out. On the Democratic side, there was a frustration that the machinery was there. So on one side, it'd say, we got what we want. Oh, crap. The loudest, arguably least informed part of the electorate got exactly what they wanted. That's a problem. And on the Democratic side, it was the loudest, most energized part of the electorate really can't overcome the machinery, which generally is how this has worked. It's, you know, 85% of the country wants gun control, but that doesn't really matter. That's sort of, I'll scream all I want about it, and it just doesn't matter because there's a machinery in place that's going to do what it's going to do.
Yeah.
And then you gave Britain this. This is an historically momentous decision that we're going to put to you, the people, and everyone was sort of surprised that, wait, you're actually putting this to the people, and you expect us to make an informed decision after generations of training us that what we want doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, and that's an interesting side to this, too, is that, of course, it is not typical for these types of votes to go through like this. This was basically Cameron refusing to blink when he was pressured on the decision to stay or not, and saying, you know, fine, let's put it to the people. Let's ask them. And fully expecting, of course, that people would be rational and sane and informed. It would not be swayed by these sort of hyper-nationalistic rhetoric that they heard from the Boris Johnsons and others over there. And he was completely wrong. And the people were not prepared, as you said. So that's exactly right. That's exactly right. I hadn't thought of it in that context. I don't know. How about you, Dave? What do you think? What do you think of this?
What bothers me the most now after this, a lot of people thought that the whole declining market thing, forecasts were a bluff. Nobody thought, you know, not nobody, but the people that voted for this were told that the markets weren't going to decline. And now, lo and behold, they, boy, have they ever.
To the tune of $1.2 trillion is what I heard. So, yeah, but go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, and then Boris now is going to be the lead. He's in the lead for the new PM slot.
Yeah, which is frightening.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. And I've heard him described by people that follow these things closer than I do as Trump with a brain, which is scary.
Yeah, if there's anything scarier than Donald Trump, it is Donald Trump with a brain and strategy and all that. Now, there are some winners in all this and in the tech world, too. Startups Group, which is a Berlin-based venture capital provider, they issued a statement immediately thereafter saying that Brexit is great news for the German startup scene. And since 2015, Berlin has surpassed London in the number and overall volume of financial transactions from startups specifically. And so they are counting on this and looking actually very positively on this, resulting in people being very unwilling to invest in the UK, being unwilling to invest in London and to bring startups or start startups or expand existing companies there. Google's already said that they're going to have a tough time making decisions. And Microsoft, too, has said they're going to have to reconsider some of the investments they were planning on making in those areas. So we could be seeing the decline of the UK, but perhaps it will mean the rise of some other sectors and some other areas.
Well, there's also this very firm notion that there's going to be another vote for Scottish independence because Scotland exceedingly wants to remain an EU member. Mm-hmm. So they would like to secede from the United Kingdom and then join the EU. And there is historical precedent for Glasgow being a financial functioning center. So, the Celtic Tiger, you know, Dublin has a history of being sort of a business-friendly tech player too. You could see within the Anglophone sphere over there, within the British Isles itself, people fleeing the United Kingdom, but not going that far. The technical and financial consequences of this are part of the reason the pound took such a beating is no one knows how this is going to shake out, and capital is going to flee to more stable markets. But yeah. As the things begin to shake out, it can continue to not shake out in London's favor.
Well, and it's, you know, that's an interesting point, though, too. So a country like Scotland, say, deciding to secede from the UK, maintain their you know, connection to the EU. But, you know, as we were talking about earlier with that geographic connection. So now someone who is a member of the EU, but Scottish, who wants to get over to Brussels, say, today literally would take a train to London and then a train from London over to Brussels, and then boom, they're done. If this were to go in that direction, that would be much, you know, it'd be complicated. And, there'd either have to be a lot more air passage available or working out some sort of border control that's relatively seamless. It just seems like it's just going to be a huge headache for so many countries, no matter what their decisions are that they make in that area.
Absolutely. Basically, this becomes instead of Britain having a connection to the EU, Britain's going to have to work out, multiple independent, free trade and free passage agreements, which is going to be very complicated. And that was sort of, for all of its bureaucratic faults, and there are many to the EU, the simplicity of dealing with one bureaucratic authority as opposed to many bureaucratic authorities could not be underestimated. That sort of thing. That's what Britain is sort of giving up there, and they basically did not want to admit to themselves as a nation that London's role as a financial capital is basically you guys speak English and you're in effectively the EU. That is convenient for America.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
if you're not in the EU, we'll learn German if we have to.
Yeah.
Or the Germans speak pretty good English, too.
That's right.
So
that's
if we have to deal directly with Berlin, okay, fine.
Yeah.
We'll go do that.
Yeah, I'll have to get out my old German primer. You know, sprechen Sie Deutsch? Ah, was ist los mit das UK? So, yeah, no, the you know, that is one thing, though, that the Brexit campaigners promised time and time and time again, is that the UK would still be able to participate in the European single market. However, and I've heard some pundits already come out with this, saying that while that may technically be true, depending on the fallout of this and depending on the sort of mood of how the exit occurs, especially if you're bringing someone like Boris Johnson to the helm, it might be really, really tricky to negotiate the details of that if there's a lot of hostility from the other EU members and the remaining EU governments, you know, and including Germany and France, and if Scotland jumps back into the EU and all this.
Forget hostility. It's a tactical move. They can't make it easy on Britain to still do business, because if there's basically no consequences of significance from leaving the EU, why wouldn't other countries that are on the fence about staying leave?
Yeah.
They have to make an example of Britain. They have to make it so that it was a painful, ill-considered move. Otherwise, you know, other countries will think, well, basically Britain's getting all the good and none of the bad. Why don't we go try that?
Yeah. 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 Now, on the good news, though, there is good news here that I did see. This came up in my feed. HBO has alerted the world that the Brexit, they are not going to allow that to hurt the Game of Thrones productions. So we'll still get a lot of boobs and dragons if you're signed up for cable. You're covered. You're covered. They aren't. They're not, she's not covered. Daenerys is never covered. But we are covered for for Game of Thrones, which has been, actually, in fact, this has been one of, since George R.R. Martin gave up some of the reins, this has been one of the best seasons since the very first one, in my mind. Certainly the most satisfying, although I'm very, very much in the camp that Lord Baelish has got a few tricks up his sleeves here now that he's entered the scene again. It remains to be seen how long Winterfell will have their flag flying. but that's probably even more wonky and geeky than the whole Brexit conversation. Well, we're at 10:50 a.m. right now, June 25th, Saturday, and I am dying to find out about Oracle and the name that they would have given to their first database product. I'm a huge fan of Oracle. I've used Oracle for literally, I think now probably I could say decades plural, and I have no clue what Larry's hotbox mind had concocted for the first really cool name for a database.
So when they first began working on what became the first version of Oracle, they didn't really have a name. And the company wasn't called Oracle Systems. It had a number of other names before that. It eventually took the name. But before Larry and his crew started their company, they worked for a number of other government contractors, or they worked on a major database project that was called Oracle. And they left and started their own database company. When those government projects got canceled, they decided, hey, Oracle's still a good name. Let's take that back. But Larry knew nobody buys the first version of any product if they're smart, especially from some upstart company. So the first version of Oracle released to market was called Oracle version 2. It was the first version, but he called it version 2 so no one would think it was a brand new product that hadn't been proven.
That's what I've been doing wrong.
There's never been such a thing as Oracle 1.0. It never existed as a commercial product.
That's what I've been doing wrong.
Never wanted to take check 101, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, you know, it worked, I guess. People did buy it. Oh man, that was completely unexpected. I wasn't sure where we were going to go with that, but you know what? That's just as canny as I guess I should have expected from Larry Ellison. Oh man. So what should we be thinking about next week then?
So next weekend is July 4th weekend, and on previous July 4th Geek Trivia, as we have talked about Supernova 1054, which was supernova that created the Crab Nebula, and it's got a July 4th connection in the sense that it was first observed by Chinese astronomers on July 4th, 1054. It's sort of the first example of major fireworks in the sky on July 4th. But it was actually a very, very long time between when it was observed as a, quote, guest star, which is a star that sort of appears and disappears in the sky in 1054, and then people figuring out that what that was actually the Crab Nebula, and that why the Crab Nebula was connected to that was a supernova that made the Crab Nebula. So that connection literally took centuries to figure out. And so the question is, what very famous astronomer figured out that the first July 4th supernova was actually the explosion that created the Crab Nebula?
Oh, that's a
exciting
great
stuff.
Question. Yeah. Oh, that's outstanding. Yeah. That's right. Next weekend is July 4th weekend. I'm looking at my calendar. I'm like, are we going to be here? Oh yeah. We'll be here. It's the second. So
yeah, the 4th of Monday.
Yeah. So that's that works out well. That works out well for us. We'll definitely be here. I'm gonna close this out here. I'm just gonna make a quick reminder though for people that we've got Robbie Rigel, Science for the Win, up next. But after that, and keep the app running so that you can listen to it in your car. But after that, everything's gonna be live from Beach Fest down at the Round Lake Beach Civic Center. So head down over there and take part in all those festivities that we mentioned earlier. And at that, I'm gonna let you go. Jay, Dave, man, what a great, I'm glad we were able to get back together and have a great conversation and kind of break down. Now that we've got Brexit figured out, we'll focus on the U.S. maybe.
Well, benevolent cyborg dictatorship is starting to sound pretty good to me right now.
I am all in. I'm an autonomous government. That's what we need. We got autonomous cars. We need autonomous leadership. And we're
there you go.
We can't be any worse off.
I'm in.
So,
all right. Take care, guys. See you
Dave,
next time.
Jay, have a great
take it
week.
Easy, fellas.
Yep. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye. Dave Sparky Saganaki, and I also got Jay Geek Trivia Garmin. Go to jgarmin.net. You'll see him there. Hey, I was not kidding. It is time for us to go. We already did our cool sites of the week, so if you missed that, make sure you catch the podcast at techtalk.wrlr.fm, and you'll catch it up that way. I'm going to leave us with a podcast-only song of the week. I'm going to do Hearts on Fire by a group that, you know, it's one of those where they took out all the vowels, so you can't pronounce the name of the artist. I think it's supposed to be Family Band, but it's FMLYBND. I don't know. Somebody can explain that to me. All caps. You'll find it. Just look for Hearts on Fire. This is, or was, Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights. Don't turn the dial. I'm not kidding. We got great stuff coming up for you right after this. Have a wonderful weekend. Either way, everyone, take care. We'll be right back.
mine, I feel that fire burning deep inside. The view from the top, looking down. I know someday we're gonna run this town. Oh, hearts on fire.